Chapter 6, Principle 1. Connect, connect, connect. The first principle is the most important and probably the most challenging. Making honest connections with yourself and those around you. Prior to meeting and marrying my husband, Dean, I secretly bought into the old line, I wouldn't want to join any club that would have me as a member. Poor guy. I think of what I put him through in the early stages of our relationship. I told my friends he was dull, not interesting, predictable. He earned a pretty severe mental berating for the sin of wanting to get to know me. I met Dean at a Toastmasters meeting. He showed up one night to check out the group, and I happened to be giving a speech about the importance of becoming an organ donor. He began attending meetings regularly. With each session, I noticed Dean maneuvered himself closer and closer, subtly tossing me, I'm interested vibes. I thought, what is wrong with this guy? He heard my speech. He knows I have all these problems. Why would he want to go out with me? Eventually, we made a date to play badminton. I have to admit, the sparks weren't exactly flying. I was used to riding a stomach-churning roller coaster of insecurity when I was dating someone. I had always been attracted to the ones who played games and didn't call when they said they would. Dean played no games. He made it clear from the start he was interested in me. Though I reported to my friends the next day that Dean was the king of boring, the truth was, he scared the hell out of me. You see, I felt comfortable with the game players, despite the self-doubt they dredged up. With them, one thing was guaranteed. I wouldn't have to get too close. I could tell, even on that first date, there was no such guarantee with Dean. Dean kept on calling, and we kept on dating. My feelings for him deepened, and I grew even more scared. I was convinced that he didn't get it. For some reason, he wasn't seeing that I was damaged goods. I truly believed that because of my illness, a man would always leave. So I tried something new. Rather than pretend the issue wasn't there, I pressed the point. I sat him down and said, "You know me with a transplant, but tomorrow the reality is I could be on dialysis again." I gave him all my books on the subject and said, "Read these, and then let me know if you still want to be with me." When Dean came back, the just-read books in his hands, he said, "Okay, if you went back on dialysis, what modality would you choose?" Dean went on to prove his faithfulness the following month when I checked into the hospital with a 104-degree temperature. My doctor feared I might be rejecting the kidney. Dean was there every day, being his solid-as-rock self. The kidney and I survived the ordeal, and Dean and I married on May 18, 1997.
The most exhausting thing in life is to be insincere. Anne Morrow Lindbergh.
The importance of identifying the truth. Put yourself first. The single most important thing you can do to ensure that you will live a happy life is to connect in an honest way. Easy to write down, hard to do. The reason it's so difficult is this. At the core of honest communication with others is telling the truth to you. The story about Dean and me is a good example. I was running around informing everyone that Dean was a doorknob when, in fact, he is a wonderful guy. When I did a little self-investigation, I realized I wasn't being honest. I was making up reasons not to like him because I didn't want to be rejected. I was afraid I was too imperfect to love, or once he saw how difficult a relationship with me would be, he'd take off. Taking appraisal of your true internal motivations is something people spend years in therapy trying to accomplish. I'm no expert in this area. I can't give you all the tools necessary to dig down until you reach your personal truths. But I can tell you this. If you come from a place of honesty, your internal core will be content no matter what's happening to you, your body, or the world. You will be unshakable. Fear, where it all breaks down. I've noticed in my own life that the biggest impediment to being honest with myself is fear. I don't think I'm alone here, especially among those who have a chronic illness. Unlike our physically healthy peers, we have to digest life-changing information on a continual basis. As a result, we have to make many more big life decisions. Should I move so I can be closer to the best healthcare? Will I be able to continue my career? Should I have a child given the health risks? These are serious questions that bring to the surface our deepest insecurities. We tend to deflect such insecurities with non-truths like, I didn't really want a baby anyway. Instead of making your big life decisions from that fearful place, I encourage you to burrow into your insecurities and find the truth that lives underneath. So, how do you start digging? You identify the trouble. I don't know about you, but I have this fictional group of people in my head who tell me things like, you're not good enough, or you're not healthy enough to make it. I call this unsavory clan the committee. What's your committee saying to you? Are you not taking risks like I almost did with Dean because somewhere inside you, you believe the committee? Here are a few more gems the committee throws my way. Perhaps these will help you identify your own fears and stretch beyond them. The committee's top five. Number one. I don't deserve my loved one's support. Number two, before I met Dean. I will never find my true love partner. Number three, I don't fit in. I'll always be an outsider. Number four, my body will only deteriorate. Who's going to stick around for this? Number five, I'll never have a good quality of life, so what's the point in trying? When your committee spouts its top five, shout back, zip a lip. Counter with the truth to stomp out the nonsense. Tell yourself that you are more than your body. You are a whole, loving, and worthwhile person who has much to give to this world. Remind the negativity crew of your vast accomplishments and recount everything, even the tiniest of victories. For some, it could be as simple as making breakfast. Counter what they have to say. To, I'll never have a good quality of life, respond, according to what standard? No, you won't go water skiing on the Delta every weekend, but you will have honest and loving relationships, and that's the best quality of life there is.
Fear less, hope more, whine less, breathe more, talk less, say more, hate less, love more, and all good things are yours. Swedish proverb.
Moving beyond the fear. Once you identify and voice your insecurities, work with your supporters to push through the fear. After I identified my anxieties about Dean, for instance, I expressed them to him. I had a responsibility to myself, to him, and to our relationship to speak with him candidly rather than continue making him feel that he wasn't good enough for me. Marty and Gordon Lohr are another example of two people who worked through their fears to reach a place of honest communication. Their heartrending story began when Marty was diagnosed with breast cancer in 1999. Complications with her treatment forced her to be virtually bedridden, and Gordon, her husband of 35 years, cared for her in their home for more than a year. Gordon describes his wife as stoic and fiercely independent, and explains that she had difficulty discussing her fears throughout the struggle. Sadly, the doctors discovered the cancer had metastasized to her brain, and shortly after I interviewed Gordon for this book, Marty passed away. Marty has always had a self-image problem and I believe was convinced I would not be there for her when she became chronically ill. For the first year, she fought any attempt I made to be her advocate with the HMO. Then she relented and slowly but surely we became closer and closer. She began to realize I really did care for her, that she was someone worthy of receiving love, even giving it. Taking care of her became my blessed burden. It taught me the lesson of giving and expecting nothing in return. That true contentment comes not from receiving love, but from giving it. Then it returns, completing the circle of the wheel. My challenge to you in each of your relationships is to connect in such a selfless and loving way. If you can set aside your fears and approach your loved ones with this kind of candor, then the first key to the chronically happy life is in your grip. Step out of roles to foster honesty. Ah, that communication could be this simple. After a couple of intense sessions with your journal, you express your epiphanies to your partner or your sister, and voila, you've got a great relationship. Sorry, it doesn't work that way. There's another person on the end of the dialogue, someone who is experiencing just as many fears as you are. Like you, she is putting up defenses, building walls, and telling untruths to hide her own anxiety. So, how do you break through? Sometimes it helps to identify the ways you and your supporters are dealing with your illness. Following our roles, I've noticed both patients and their loved ones take on to cope. Do any of these strike a chord with you? The ostrich. Ostriches pretend that nothing is happening, preferring to hide their heads in the sand. Gordon Lohr said this is how his wife took the news of her breast cancer. It appeared to me that she was in a somewhat state of denial, so I did not ask questions when we visited the various doctor's offices, he explains. I asked the questions I thought were necessary, but she resented it, saying sometimes in the doctor's office that it was her body and she resented me or anybody else making decisions about her body. I responded that somebody had to act as her advocate since she did not appear to be doing so. Marty's understandable feelings of denial made communication heated in the beginning stages of her illness, Gordon says. Her silence left her feeling left out of important healthcare decisions. Meanwhile, Gordon was feeling alone as he attempted to pursue the best course of treatment for her. It wasn't until she addressed her fear and let go of her resentment that she was able to trust her husband as an advocate rather than an enemy. The victim. The victim is best described as a person who cannot pick herself up and move on. It's unfair to have a chronic illness or to be a loving supporter of someone who is sick. It's normal to grieve the loss many times over. But when you can't get past that grief, a problem sets in. If she is the patient, she may let others do for her more than is necessary or reasonable. If you can identify, I suggest you attempt one small thing each day that your caretaker currently handles. As you accept more responsibility, you'll surprise yourself at what you can do. Your confidence will build, and so will your sense of independence. As you begin to do more for yourself, it will get easier for you to talk about your fears. Why? By taking action, you have already started to face them. The martyr. When a caregiver falls into the martyr role, she tends to set aside her own needs to look after her loved ones, but then resents it later. My family has a few examples of martyrs, and it's not a stretch to understand why. My kidney disease has put them through hell. They had to place their lives on hold as we spent much of our time fighting my disease together. The problem is, for many years, they wouldn't let me forget it. They told me my illness was the reason they hadn't found satisfaction in their own lives. I still carry the resulting guilt, and many of my actions have sprouted from that shame-filled place. After I recognized this pattern in my family, I delicately approached it with my mom. In emotional conversations like these, I always try to remind myself that my mother did her very best based on her resources. It's important to stay non-judgmental because casting blame only deepens the problem. If you see the martyr dynamic emerging in your relationships, I suggest you talk about it as I did. Let your loved ones know how it hurts you. I guarantee they aren't aware of their actions, so be mindful of this when you bring it up. If you approach the topic tactfully and with love, void of resentment, remember, they're hurting too. Everyone will benefit. The overbearing caretaker. When you were first diagnosed with a chronic illness or are recovering from surgery, you really do need help. It is emotionally comforting and gives your body time to heal when someone is there to lighten the load. There comes a time, however, when independence becomes important again. Loved ones who fall into the overbearing caretaker category can have a hard time with this transition. They prefer to dote on you, fluff your pillows, cook your meals, and, in general, make sure every tiny need is met. What darlings! How wonderful they are to tend to you so selflessly. But there is a difficulty in this setup. It has the potential of robbing you, subtly, of the very thing most central to your future: your independence. You must do for yourself, lest you become a victim. Such a pattern is not always healthy for the caretaker either. He may be gaining his sense of self-worth based on your neediness. When it comes time to pull back, it can be difficult because he won't feel useful anymore. Although it may be a bit uncomfortable, let your caregiver know that you're ready to get back to normal as soon as possible. Talk in specific terms about the tasks you'd like to do for yourself, then make sure you follow through by actually doing them. Listen to what your caretaker has to say. It may turn out his fussing around is grounded. He may be justifiably concerned that you'll take on too much. If you've been bedridden for several days, for instance, a walk by yourself may not be that great an idea. Open discussions are the first step toward mutual understanding and a workable compromise. Pity party organizer. Even those closest to you may not know how to act when thrust in a caretaker role. This is especially true of the pity party organizer. Your loved ones who fit in this category are most likely very sympathetic characters. You love them because they are so concerned, and they drive you nuts because they are too darn sad to be around. They want so much to help, but their words and actions make you feel like such a victim. A friend of mine who has cancer gets calls 10 times a day from a member of her family to find out how she's doing. Although she appreciates the concern, she wants to scream, "Enough already! Stop feeling sorry for me!" For those of you who have loved ones who are throwing you daily pity parties, tell them you don't want them anymore. Let them know you'd prefer to be asked questions like, what would be the best way for me to support you through this? Would you like to talk about what's happening and how you're feeling about it? It may not be a very comfortable conversation, but I think it is necessary. Another strategy is to ask the pity party organizers how they are feeling. For one, this will move the focus from you. Next, expressing their concerns might unburden them and alleviate some of their anxiety. Find out why they are scared. If they are thinking worst-case scenario, let them talk about it. The reality is that everyone who deals with a chronic illness thinks about death. It's impossible not to, even if your particular disease doesn't have a high percentage of fatalities. Armed with facts, they may be less likely to treat you like a Fabergé egg.
It is understanding that gives us an ability to have peace. Harry S. Truman.
Connecting with those you love. Don't forget to tend to your relationships. Here's the bad news. No matter who you are, relationships take work, and when you have a chronic illness, they take even more. The good news is, your health can inspire you to form more fulfilling relationships with every person in your circle. Use the new mental perspective you've gained from your illness to strengthen the ties most important to you. Anne Fulton is a therapist in Halifax, Nova Scotia, and she works with people suffering from chronic illness. Fulton herself lives with environmental illness, a condition in which exposure to chemicals found in common agents, such as newsprint, cleansers, and perfumes, can bring on severe physical reactions, such as shortness of breath, muscle aches, fatigue, and headaches. She explains how ill health forces us to look more closely at ourselves and the most important relationships in our lives. Illness and a hectic pace of life do not coexist well. Illness forces us to slow down, examine priorities, and make significant changes. We come face to face with the person we are moving too quickly to get to know on some deeper levels, ourselves. Our perspective can shift, often in amazing ways. It is this new perspective that may incline us to rework the relationships that survive our illness so that they are deeper and more satisfying. With environmental illness and other illnesses, it's not always easy to approach conflicts. If you are just too sick to do so, do not have the physical or emotional energy, or if the other person just really doesn't get it. I've found illness usually shows you which friends really can be there for you and lend support in a healthy way, and which friends, even if well-intentioned, just can't. If your energy is limited, it makes more sense to save this precious energy for relationships that are supportive and easily workable. As Fulton suggests, you will greatly need your support group as you ride the peaks and valleys of your health problems. The best way to make sure the network doesn't break down in times of crisis is to tend to it like a precious garden each day. Your partner. The most important plot of your garden is your primary relationship, which, for many of us, is our spouse or life partner. The stress of a chronic illness can threaten the most loving relationships, leaving both of you reeling at the time when you most need support. How can you tend to your relationship when you feel you have nothing to give? How can your spouse continue to treat you as an equal when he is also your caregiver? How can you connect when this illness has taken over both of your lives? These are questions that come up for most couples as they face chronic illness. I can tell you from experience, if you keep the lines of communication open, you will get through this, no matter how difficult. Remember to empathize. First, You need to understand. I mean, really get your partner's feelings. In the beginning stages, he is caught up in the same whirlwind you are, going through the cycle of shock, denial, anger, and depression that I addressed in the first chapter. It may help you to read that chapter again with this new viewpoint. As you read, see the loss through his eyes. Take all these emotions and add one more: helplessness, and then you'll have an idea of your partner's struggle. This illness is yours, and as much as he wants to take it away from you, he can't. To make him feel included, let him in. Although you can't do many of the things you used to do, you can probably talk. You have a responsibility to be honest about your illness. Don't exaggerate or hide the symptoms, including the emotional ones. The more you communicate, the less left out your partner will feel, and the less likely he'll be to beat himself up or to feel resentful later. Greg Pyburn explains how it felt to mutely watch his wife suffer while he looked on, unknowing, in his book, Beyond Chaos, One Man's Journey Alongside His Chronically Ill Wife. How can a man sitting in the upper deck spot an offensive lineman moving an instant before the center snaps the ball, but not detect that his wife is dropped into the funk of depression? How can a person take corporate-sponsored sensitivity training but be blind to the fact a loved one lives in fear of some nameless, faceless enemy? How can people get so concerned about the gnats buzzing around their heads that they often ignore the elephants bearing down on their significant others? Take the guesswork away from your partner by telling him clearly what you're going through. With a chronic illness, the straightforward approach is best. It's the way both of you will get your needs met. Partner as caregiver. When your partner becomes your caregiver, you are both entering into an unwilling relationship. This is not how either of you wanted it to go. Such a dynamic is rife with complexities, but, like most difficult endeavors, can have its rewards. It has the capacity to reveal unconditional love and can act as an affirmation of the patient's place in loved ones' hearts. "Caring for my dear wife is not something I would trade," says Gordon Lohr, who continued to visit his wife at her nursing home every day. "It made a better person of me, and I believe has made her aware that she was really loved more than she knew." The Lohrs lived with Marty's illness for 3 years. This type of acceptance won't happen overnight. First, you have to work through the strife that caregiving can cause. One problem is burnout. Fulton suggests avoiding this by sharing the burden of care. You need to be constantly renewed in order to constantly give, she explains. One person can't do it all. It may take a while, but when burnout sets in, the lone caregiver is left feeling exhausted, overwhelmed, irritable, and more vulnerable to illness themselves. It's only a matter of time before the relationship between the ill person and the caregiver is stretched beyond a reasonable capacity. In the case of spouses, if this situation is left unchecked, the unique overtones of marriage can become so drastically altered that the magic that brought two lovers together can be seen sailing adrift on a distant horizon. Pauline Salvucci, a licensed marriage and family therapist, spent 10 years counseling family caregivers and people living with chronic illnesses. "Spousal caregivers are often their own worst enemies, thinking they have to do it all," They don't put into the equation that they have to take care of themselves or they won't be able to take care of their partner. In order to take care of themselves, they have to be willing to ask for help, know their limitations, and create boundaries. In the case of married couples, it's not uncommon for women to take too much on. It's a mistake. The partner needs to be responsible for as much as he can. I coach a lot of angry, burned out, and frustrated women who waited too long before realizing they can't do it all. Becoming a parent to their spouse or sacrificing their physical and emotional health doesn't work. Today, Salvucci runs Self-Care Connection, an internet-based coaching business where she helps clients tend to themselves, particularly during chronic illness. She works with both ill people and their caretakers. On her website, she draws a poignant analogy. Lifeguards always put a life vest on themselves, grab their can, and connect it to themselves before ever venturing into the water to help the victim. Ever wonder why that is? They understand that you have to get yourself into the best position possible before you are able to help anyone else. If you or your caretaker is burning out, one solution is to seek help. Self-Care Connection is just one example of the many resources available to people in your position. Another practical solution is to have your partner give up some of the caregiving duties. Check into your insurance options. What kind of home care are you entitled to? Can a physical therapist come in a couple times a week? Can a home nurse relieve your partner regularly during the day? Review some of the resources we discussed in Chapter 4 to see if there are any local nonprofits that can help you with grocery delivery, daily meals, or financial relief so you can afford additional in-home care. Here's another action you or your caregiver can take that is a quicker, easier fix. Unplug. Disconnect and unwind for at least a few hours on a regular basis. Take some time off to hang out with friends, go bird watching, or veg out in front of the television. Whatever the trick, the best way for a caregiver to avoid burnout is to take care of themselves too.
The only thing to do is to hug one's friends tight and to do one's job. Edith Wharton.
Connect with your minds. How do you maintain a good connection with your partner when he or she suddenly feels like a parent? One solution is to shift your relationship focus from doing to thinking. Relate with each other where you are still able to engage, with your brains. Bring in outside materials to get your minds moving in the same direction. Movies, puzzles, projects, whatever it takes. Work side by side on a plan to, say, remodel your house, even if a remodel is light years away. Jotting down your dreams together will remind you that you can continue to look forward, even if your illness is pulling your body back. More ideas. Each of you subscribes to different magazines. After you've both read your issues, swap. You read one article in your partner's and ask your partner to read one in yours. The resulting discussions will engage both of you and will affirm that each of you take interest in the other's passions. You can also join an online book club together. Or, in a more spiritual vein, you can pray together. Even if you don't believe in the same higher power, channeling spiritual energy can help you relinquish your burden, while at the same time bring you closer with your partner. Accept change. Just as you have to accept your life will be different with a chronic illness, in some ways better, in other ways worse, you both need to accept your relationship will change. If you continue to fight to make your relationship what it was, you will never be able to see what it is and what it can be. Christopher Reeve was known throughout the world for playing the title character in Superman. But he said that it wasn't until his tragic horseback riding accident in 1995 that he came to really understand the meaning of the word hero. An ordinary individual who finds the strength to persevere and endure in spite of overwhelming obstacles. They are the real heroes, and so are the families and friends who stood by them. Christopher's wife, Dana, who was an accomplished actor and singer, put much of her career on hold in order to care for her husband. In a December 1999 interview with the Westchester Wag, Dana Reeves spoke about how she and her husband dealt with his new disabilities. "We don't have some secret formula that other people don't have. You need to find a place where both of you can grow and yet also stay together. It's about appreciating the other person fully, warts and all. I think if we hadn't been in that frame of mind from the day we got married, I don't think we would survive what we're going through now." Sadly, both Christopher and Dana passed away in 2004 and 2006, respectively. But their commitment to each other and to their community lives on through the Christopher and Dana Reeve Foundation. www.christopherreeve.org. Seek help. Chronic illness can bring up so many difficulties in relationships. Sometimes the best way to work through them is by getting outside help. Your doctor can probably refer someone to help both of you deal with the emotions of your illness, or you can seek counseling independently. There are marriage counselors who specifically work with couples coping with chronic illness. You may be able to find a support group that welcomes couples. You can go to your synagogue and speak to your rabbi. You can enroll in workshops, seminars, or retreats that cater to couples facing chronic illness. And of course, there are numerous online groups and bulletin boards where you can find support. Whatever you do, don't forget to reach out. No matter how bad it gets, you are not alone. There are systems in place to help people struggling with exactly the problems you are facing. Use them. Sexuality and chronic illness. I know that connecting sexually is one of the most important aspects of a loving partnership, but frankly, sometimes it seems impossible. Between the medications, low hormone levels, irregular lab values, pain, and exhaustion, how can we want to have sex? This is a problem every couple coping with chronic illness confronts. It's tough for both partners, the one who is sick and the one who feels neglected or denied. David Axtman has been on dialysis for 33 years. In that first year, when he and his wife Marlene were both 27, Axtman struggled with his sexuality, to the point that his wife said that she felt that the sight of her naked body repulsed her young husband. The couple took a proactive stance in solving the issue by scheduling an appointment with Axtman's doctors. "One of the greatest assets of our relationship is that we are able to discuss any problem," says Axtman, who has been married to Marlene 40 years. "In addressing this subject, we did find some good and necessary help. Axtman's doctor said his troubles were most likely psychological." The couple sought counseling, researched ways to improve their lovemaking, and experimented with methods that would be new and stimulating to both of them. "Sex has never been the most important part of our love for each other, but it is a significant part. I feel it is a form of expression that should grow with a successful marriage, Axtman explains. The important issue here is that Marlene and I have enough concern for each other to deal with the problem, and not to spend the rest of our lives wondering about each other's feelings. Like the Axtmans, if you are having sexual problems, such as impotence or lack of desire, I suggest you talk to your doctor. Find out if the problem is physical or psychological. If it's physical, for instance, your medication is lowering your libido, see if your doctor can help by adjusting the dosage. If it's psychological, don't shy away from the topic. Discuss it with your partner. Importantly, let her know that you find her sexy, but your body is just not working the way you'd like it. Healing the negative touch perception. For those of us who've spent a lot of time under medical care, an unconscious tendency to recoil at touch often develops, which can have a negative impact on our sex lives. The countless episodes of medical poking, prodding, and sticking have instilled us with a sort of negative programming. For many of us, touching is no longer a pleasure, but a sterile precursor to discomfort or pain, and as a result, even a caring hug from a friend can cause us to become stiff and obviously uncomfortable. To reprogram my negative touch perception, I slowly introduced pleasurable touch to my life. I began by getting monthly massages. As it turned out, these were more healing than I could have imagined. This ancient medical treatment offered a profound means by which I could enjoy a positive human connection and forget touch's invasive past in my life. Massage has made me more comfortable with all forms of physical contact, from a friend's reassuring pat to my husband's loving caresses. I am now able to relax and enjoy one of the most precious gifts one person can give another.
A faithful friend is the medicine of life. Apocrypha.
Forming new relationships. Dating advice from someone who's been there. I know not all of you reading this book are getting through your illness with a life partner by your side. You are relying on your parents, your friends, and your siblings. These solid relationships are what will help you get through. But what happens when new people enter your circle? When you live with a chronic illness, going out with a new person can be more complex than it is for the rest of the world. Things can grow awkward if you disclose your illness sooner than you are ready. Dating can be a bear because of the negative self-esteem that often accompanies illness, and sexuality can get a little dicey. Do I tell him about the catheter after we've started making out, or before our first kiss? Having kissed a lot of frogs before marrying Dean in my 30s, I'm somewhat of a pro in this area, and I uncovered a few gems of wisdom, however unconventional, along the way. Practice dating. For many years, I proudly considered myself very discriminating when it came to the men I dated. Why waste my time on somebody who doesn't ring my chimes, I figured. Then one night I was out with a group of friends and we got into the inevitable topic of men. As I started with the familiar drone about there being no suitable guys, my friend popped in with, "Lori, don't you know the rule? You go out with anybody who doesn't give you the creeps." Letting this concept sink in for a minute, I finally replied, "Really?" She then went on to explain the importance of what she calls practice dating. Ask any professional pianist or baseball player, and they will surely tell you their performance directly correlates to the amount of time they put into practicing. Makes sense? So why should the dating game be any different? For some reason, we have the mystical notion that when presented with an attractive individual and a free evening, we'll come out smelling like a rose. Well, for the extrovert with God-given social skills, a year-round tan, and a rare sense of self-confidence, that may be true. For the rest of us, especially those whose self-confidence has taken a back seat to health worries, the going isn't so easy. We need practice relating to the opposite sex. We must learn how to relax around, be comfortable with, and speak the same language as our gender opposite. Spending a few evenings practice dating with these non-Casanovas can help us learn the social skills and expertise that will enable us to be open and gracious when the right one comes along. Also, with practice dating, you open yourself up to people you may have passed by in your more snobbish days. I can tell you from experience, sometimes the practice session turns into the big game. As I mentioned earlier, Dean was one of those non-Casanova types. Not that he isn't cute. He's plenty cute. But I was used to a much more flashy kind of guy. You know, the type who flashes into your life, shoves your heart through a meat grinder, and flashes out again. Luckily for both of us, I had had the talk with my friend before I met Dean. He didn't give me the creeps, so I went for it. And look what happened with us. You're in the driver's seat. Practice dating also helps build confidence. The more you go out, check out a person, see if you like him, see if you don't, the more you'll realize that you're in the driver's seat, deciding whether this person is right for you rather than the other way around. So often with chronic illness, it's difficult to detach your sense of self-worth from the fact that your body isn't working the way you wish it would. Translate that to dating, and the next thing you know, you're ready to marry whoever comes along. Meeting a lot of people helps you realize that your date is just as fortunate to be in your company as you are in his. Practice dating can also show you that insecurities you have around your illness may be unfounded. After living with lupus for years and receiving a successful kidney transplant, Julie Glennon had anxiety about dating because she wasn't able to have children. She wondered if men would still find her attractive as a companion. Getting into the dating circuit cleared up her concern. My thing is, I kept plugging away date after date. Surprisingly, a lot of these guys were really okay with this, the infertility. A lot of them had dated divorced women with children, and that was more of a headache. I found that it wasn't really that much of a problem, Glennon explains. The bigger problem, she says, was determining the correct timing on disclosure. I kind of drop the bomb periodically, she explains, laughing. I always say the kidney transplant first because that's kind of like you're cured. The sticky issue of when to tell. Back in the days when I thought of myself as damaged goods, I had little or no discretion about sharing the details of my illness with anyone who would listen. In truth, my self-esteem was so poor, and I was so afraid of intimacy that I would tell every new date my whole story. I was living out my old self-fulfilling prophecy that said, I can never really be loved because I'm damaged, and if you don't believe me, let me tell you about it. As a result, I cried many tears over the men who ended up uttering the F word in my direction. Lori, I just want to be your friend. As the years passed and I became more emotionally healthy, I learned that such conversations needed to be reserved for the right setting, with a person truly interested in my life and my friendship. When I learned to wait, I found having that discussion was one way to cement the new relationship. That said, when it comes to getting involved with someone romantically, I don't advise you to hold off disclosure until you are seriously dating. I'm not talking the first date, but I do believe the person you are seeing has the right to know and should want to know the real you.
There is a great deal of unmapped country within us. George Eliot.
Live truthfully. Strong connections will follow. Whether you are striking up a new relationship or working on an old one, connecting boils down to one simple principle. Tell the truth. If you walk away with anything from this chapter, these are the words I want you to store in your memory banks and pull out again and again. In every conversation with yourself, your partner, your children, or your newfound friends, ask yourself if the words coming out of your mouth are matching the feelings in your heart. If they are, you will connect in a fulfilling way. It isn't always easy to approach the emotions that come with illness with honesty, especially when they can be mired in so much anger, shame, and remorse. But if you do, you will reap lifelong rewards. David Fulton had kidney failure and lived on dialysis for 34 years. When his daughter, Adela Robinson, was a little girl, she would lay her head on her father's fistula, the permanent access point for a dialysis needle. He had two big ones on his hand. I would kneel by his bed, and my ear would rest on his warm, swollen hand, and I would listen. I could hear a thumping, beating sound. I would turn to my father and laugh. He would ask me, "What do you hear?" I would say, "It's the giant, and he's walking up the stairs, his feet thumping loud." It was our little game. This is how I handled his fistula, that funny-looking vein which appeared on his hand and made it look odd and deformed, but was his lifeline. He never felt shy, embarrassed, or angry that such attention was brought to his disfigurement. He knew these moments built a special bond between us, and to this day are some of my fondest memories of my father. By respecting his daughter enough to approach matters truthfully, without fear, David Fulton's connection with her was unbreakable. It grew steadily until his death in 1998. Today, Robinson's memories of her father bespeak the loving relationship they enjoyed while he was alive. I encourage you to let the truth lead you to equally fulfilling connections. "I looked at him as one of the strongest and bravest men I ever knew," Robinson explains. "When I would see my father each morning, I would see him smiling with such a shine in his eyes. I'd say, 'Daddy, what are you smiling about?' And he'd say, with his fist held high in the air, 'Life, life, life.'" Polly wants some communication. My parrot, Johnny, has an unbelievable ability to mimic everything. The car alarm, the cat's meow, television commercial slogans such as, "Milk does a body good," the phone ringing, even my voice. What he'll do is, he'll ring the phone and answer just like I do. "Brrrring, hello. What are you doing?" "Uh-huh. Uh-huh. Yeah. Uh-huh. Can you hold on for a second? Beep." He does call waiting, too. Needless to say, having Johnny around is like having a tape recorder next to me playing back my life. All day, Johnny lets me know what I sound like, and I have to admit, it isn't always good. Some days, Johnny talks a lot, letting me know I could be doing more listening and less chatting. Lori's Toolbox 10. Relationship Defibrillator. Keep love alive. I don't care how strong your relationship is, I can guarantee that its heartbeat will stall from time to time as you make your way through illness. When this happens, pull out the defibrillator and start jolting. Here are some relationship energizers that will leave you both feeling better by day's end. Ask questions and listen. The single most revitalizing thing you can do for your relationship is to connect mentally. The key to connecting is asking questions and really listening to the answer. Ask anything from, "How are you feeling?" to, "What are your thoughts on the city council race?" Doesn't matter. Having great conversations can be more fulfilling than physically connecting. The good news is talking is something most of us can do even on our bad days. Recharge yourself. Reserve your energy, sit in a park, take a nap, talk to a friend. Do something to revitalize yourself so you have energy left for your partner. Set aside your illness. It's vital that you meet around something other than your condition. Watch the sunset, go to a spa together. Whatever you do, make sure you don't talk about your health for a block of time each day. Do whatever your partner wants. When your partner is also your caregiver, it is vital to give back. Pick a day when your partner gets to do anything she wants. She has a responsibility to pick something that you are able to do, too, of course. If that means you'll have to watch the history of spiders on video and you have arachnophobia, so be it. You can cover your eyes. Mind your manners. This advice is very easy to heed and yields great results. Say please, thank you, and I love you as often as you can. Melrose Place in a One Piece. When I was 20, I lived in an apartment complex that resembled Melrose Place. Lots of beautiful tanned people living around a pool. My Melrose crush was with the star of the pool volleyball team. He was about as deep as his tan, but of course, I didn't know that then. So when the time came in our relationship for me to tell him about my kidney disease and to explain why I was the only one around the pool who wore a one-piece bathing suit to hide my catheter, I shouldn't have been surprised by his reaction. "I've got something to tell you," I said, having finally mustered the courage to bring up the subject. "I'm on dialysis." "Oh man, I would rather die than do that," he replied. Doing my best to keep my composure, I responded, "Well, it is a good thing I am the one on dialysis, or we wouldn't be having this conversation, would we?" I rose up from the poolside chair and walked to my apartment, where I cried the rest of the night. Clearly, this was not the time in the relationship to divulge my health status. Not so much because of my boyfriend, but because of me. I was so insecure. I let his comment cut me to the core. I was unable to see it as anything other than a rejection of me, when I can now see it was a rejection of something he didn't understand. His comment was flip, true. But in all fairness to him, it wasn't that bad. It just wasn't very smart. He didn't even know what dialysis was, and because he was ignorant, he made a statement based on fear. In fact, once he understood dialysis, he was fine with it, and we continued dating for a year after that. So when the time comes to tell, test the waters to be sure your new friend is ready to hear the information. And, just as importantly, ask yourself if you are ready to face a less than perfect response. Lori's Toolbox, Online Dating. 12 Tips for Safe Online Dating, copied from OnlineDatingMagazine.com. There's a nervousness, thrill, and excitement that occurs when meeting a person for the first time face to face. Yet, amongst the thrill, remember to always be on your guard when going out on a date with somebody you barely know. Here are 12 tips on dating safety to help you get started. 1. Arrange to meet him. When meeting for the first time, never allow your date to pick you up from your home. In fact, your date shouldn't even know your home address yet. 2. Meet in public places. For a first meeting, always meet in a public place where other people are in close proximity. You may also want to consider going out with a group of people or a double date. 3. Go Dutch by paying half of the bill. It's always respectful for the man to offer to pay the bill. Unfortunately, some men ruin the gesture by expecting something in return. Therefore, it may not be a bad idea for you to go Dutch. Pay half of the bill so that you won't feel under any obligation to return the favor. 4. Remember that alcohol affects your judgment. The biggest threat to a person's judgment when on a date is alcohol. Not only does it affect your judgment, but alcohol also lessens your inhibitions. If you are drinking, keep your drink in sight at all times and don't get so drunk that you don't know what you're doing. Better yet, try to avoid alcohol on your first date. 5. Use your own mode of transportation. Provide your own transportation to your public meeting place and make sure you have more than enough gas. 6. Don't assume that a man is safe. It's important never to let your guard down when on a first date. Never assume a man is safe just because he claims to be religious or a gentleman. 7. Don't let him know where you live. If you want to see him again, arrange a second date and then take it from there. 8. Avoid secluded areas. Remember, stay in a public place for your first date and avoid secluded areas such as parks. 9. Listen to your gut. If something doesn't feel right, it probably isn't. And if you haven't met him before and you know at the beginning of the date that something doesn't feel right, then leave immediately. 10. Always let someone else know where you are going. Be sure someone knows where you're going and who you'll be with. You might even consider arranging a time to call and check in, or you could arrange to meet up with friends later that night. 11. Give him your cell phone number. It's safer to give out a cell phone number instead of your home phone number. 12. Always remain alert. Even if you're having a blast and the chemistry is great, it's a good idea to remain alert the whole evening. Make sure you have your cell phone on you.